And I will share my screen momentarily. Okay, can everyone see the slides? I'm good to go. Thumbs up. All right, we are good. All right, so I want to take the opportunity to talk about perhaps a little bit of an unusual topic or subject to think about Purim, or frankly, any time of the year. A story of an individual who lived, who died less than 100 years ago, and I'd like to share a little bit of his story. But before we do that and learn about the legendary Sigmund, also known as Zisha, or even Gershon Breitbart. Before we do that, I'd like to frame that in context of Purim and Purim Torah and a little bit of what we know about this time of year. We know that Purim is, of course, a day and a time period of radical changes, of reversals, of the adoption of new personas, and really performances almost. And when we think about performance, for me, I think about my days in yeshiva, when it was traditional for there to be a Purim spiel, where very often the esteemed and most highly honored individual in the entire yeshiva community, the Rosh Yeshiva, very often would just be sitting there and just have a seat, perhaps toward the front, perhaps not, but would be played by one of the outstanding young individuals in the yeshiva. And very often that was considered to be the high point of Purim. And we know there are countless stories about Purim rabbis and even Purim kings at various points in history. One case that is recorded, the students are said, in a particular yeshiva, are said to have acted at a trial of their Rebbe, so insulting and inappropriate that it was later considered to be, quote unquote, the greatest outrage in the history of Israel. And that was your Purim spiel. Right? Worse than the Chereiga, worse than the sin of the Meraglim, the spies, the golden calf, right? Take all the sins in Jewish history, but this was considered to be the worst. And we can imagine people do get away, and most years anyway, tend to get a little bit carried away. And so we can imagine things might have gone awry, but this is somehow part of the Purim spirit. In another instance, the antics crossed every boundary, proved so embarrassing to the yeshiva that it was censored from one particular yeshiva's reference, or one yeshiva's records, in deference to, quote, the honor of Yerushalayim. So we know the city in which the yeshiva was located, but the actual identity has been kept under wraps. And we know that really, it's not just the Purim spiels, and it's not just the Purim Torah, and it's not just the Purim kings and the Purim rabbis, but there are a series of halachic reversals, or really performances, I think it's fair to say, that stand out over the course of the history, the very rich history of Purim. If anyone thinks that our Purim nowadays is generally, in a healthier year and in a typical year, is perhaps a bit overboard, that may well be, that may well not be the case, but either way, certainly we have nothing on some earlier eras in Jewish history. Just so a classic example that if we take a look at another example, and hold on 1 second. Just have to figure out one thing. There we go. Okay, just to take one example, there's a classic comment of the Rama, of Moshe Israelis, the classic Ashkenazic codifier of Halacha, and in a well-known halachic presentation, he writes that in the second line, that Machinagu Lilbosh Partsufim Bepurim Vegever Lovesh Simlas Isha Viisha Kli Gever, and that which it is traditional or it is customary to wear essentially garments or clothing of the opposite gender, any sur badavar, so at least according to the Rama, against the disagreement, the vociferous disagreement of many subsequent poskim, in isur badavar miachar shein mechavin el simcha bi alma, right, that's it's merely for the sake of joy. V'chein b'levishas kil'ayim dirabanan. Similarly, there are those who permit kil'ayim, at least rabbinic instance of the mixture of wool and linen. The Rama's mekil on that, again, over the protests of others. V'chein b'nei adam ha'chodfim zemi zeh derech simcha. You grab things, right? Sounds like we're familiar with this. Perhaps some Simchas Torah, but they had it on Purim, in Bazeh Mishum Lo Sigzol, and so on and so forth. But don't go too overboard. Eventually, Yaseh Davar Shelo Kogen Al Pi Tuvei Yer. Consult your local Orthodox rabbinic authority, or in this case, perhaps it's more of a, interestingly enough, a lay authority, in this case, which itself might be a reversal. But be that as it may, we know that many of these kinds of laxities have been endemic to Purim over the course of many, many, many centuries, and is certainly not anything new. Some of these performances, which are most interesting, include, for example, this particular is a piece that was a record, a great English article, if anyone's interested, by a professor of Talmud by the name of Jeffrey Rubinstein, and he collects many of these examples. Most of them are medieval, but some other examples as well. So, for example, on the fourth line here on Purim, however, in line with the theatrical performances in carnival atmosphere, men and women sometimes wore the clothing of the opposite sex, as we noted. An observer recounted that he observed men and women exchanging clothing in the Frankfurt synagogue, and thus altar, they ran around like mad. Right? In England, brothers and sisters dressed in each other's attire, and horror of horrors in the East European academies, right? So this is in the great Eastern European yeshivas. If Purim antics required female characters, so be it. So students borrowed clothing from the daughters of the Rosh Yeshiva. Okay, so that seems to be quite unusual and fairly extreme. We have another example also cited by Rubinstein about children, about the reversal of children and adults. As one scholar noted toward the end of the fourth line, Purim is unique in that it was customary for children to insult adults and adults to accept criticism and commands from children. Various customs gave concrete expression to this reversal. In Zahul Kurdistan, they gave the first of Adar Skirat, they called the first of Adar Skirat Shiarim, closing of gates. When a father came home from work, the gates of his courtyard were locked by children who refused to open them until he gave them money or a gift. Sounds like Afikomen, but exponentially to the nth degree. That same thing happened on Purim Eve when the father returned home from the synagogue, locked out unless he would give his children presents. So reversals, roles that are normally not adopted, v'naha fochu, as it says in the Megillah. All of this is essential to the history and really woven into the fabric of the way in which we have celebrated Purim over the course of many, many, many centuries, over the course of the years. This is another source. Won't read all the details, but essentially the Shabbat HaBachurim, in which the youth, it was basically a youth Shabbos in the Shul in Worms, in Vermeiza, one of the great Ashkenazic strongholds over the course of the Middle Ages, and also great victims of the Crusades in 1096. And yet, in this particular Shabbos, instead of the Gevir and the wealthy individuals in the community occupying their prominent chairs, instead, now it was given to the children. And as Rubinstein writes here in the middle, now status in Jewish society has received a concrete expression in synagogues. The wealthy had synagogue offices, received the most coveted ritual honors, occupied the chief seats by appropriating the offices and conducting services according to their fancy. The young men or common people reversed the normal course of affairs. The children in the shul were able to sit up on the bima as if they were the gevirim in the shul, the chashav, the donors who had given hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars to the community, to the shul, to the local yeshiva, what have you. And now, instead, they've given up their chairs, and instead, it's those who typically recite the yigdal in front of the community are now in those chashava seats, as if children of age 7 had donated millions to the local institutions in the community. That's just another example and this perhaps the most radical of them all. In German Jewish communities, communal prohibitions against gambling were lifted on Hanukkah and Purim. So we know Hanukkah, we're familiar sort of, right? I don't know about we'd permit gambling in the full-fledged way, although certainly we're familiar with dreidel and all of that. Games of chance, lotteries, and even dice, of course, in the spirit of Purim, Apur, lotteries and even dice games would be permitted, and perhaps most radically of all, in Kurdistan, young men would eat a Purim meal with young women, an event that, quote, according to local halachic authority at that time, would not even be considered on any other day. So this illicit and problematic su'uda involving young men and women at the same table, perhaps at whether it be a wedding meal kind of arrangement, whatever, what have you, that is considered to be a radical reversal and one of the, again, performances, as it were, public reversal that would take place on Purim over the course of history. And the question really becomes, not only, this sounds really unusual. How do we justify this on a halachic level? And of course, each of these individual issues has been subject to tremendous dispute. And I don't mean to paskin that any of this is permissible, but I do mean to say that there are those who had this practice and some rabbanim who allowed and encouraged at least some of these activities, many of the activities over many years. And of course, for each one that was permitted, there was another rav who was machmir, kind of the inverse of what the Gemara says in one place, that anything Kadosh Baruch Hu gave us that he prohibited to us, he permitted. So here too, on Purim, anything that was permitted was prohibited by another rav. There's no question about that. So I'm not here lahalacha lamasa, but I am here to raise the question about Purim in general. We have all these activities, all these role reversals, but I would say again more, especially in the case of the Purim spiel, of the Purim king, of the Purim rabbi, of these public personas that are played out in the community in this kind of way, the children adopting the status of the gvirim in the community, and of course when we wear masks and we wear costumes on Purim, we're all putting on that performance in that way. What exactly is the significance of this? Why is it that we engage in this? And of course, over the course of history, this is true not only in these ways, but with regard to Jewish and Gentile relations, which we'll see be immediately relevant as well. Jews in various communities burned Haman in effigy, and they would take various items, take shoes, write the name Haman on the bottom of the shoes, clot them together. It's actually, there are those who think that that's where the contemporary practice of Grager comes from. So even with regard to Jews, who generally were historically very often tragically subject to anti-Semitic mistreatment over the course of millennia, of course, the Jews would take the opportunity to recall that Haman is eternally, unfortunately, with us, and yet take it as an opportunity, perhaps, to vent. And that really raises the fundamental question, which I want to pose: what are these performances all about? Is this sort of an escape valve? Is this a way of, after a long winter, and especially long and very difficult and painful year, this year in particular, there's a need to somehow just release a little bit of that nervous energy of some of the difficulties that we've gone through, even during a typical year, during Lahavdil, but still nonetheless, the notion that we need a release, is that what this is really all about? How do we understand the significance or the meaning of these role reversals, and is there a model perhaps for this in Jewish history over the course of a typical year? And what I want to do is to suggest that there may be, believe it or not, in addition to the halachic and hashkafic sources per se, a very unusual and unexpected model from Jewish history, someone who really donned the garb of performances and really was dressed up in costume, not once a year, but on a daily basis, in a very interesting sort of way, and adopted a very perhaps unexpected persona. And that is, of course, the example this evening that we're going to jump into, Sigmund Breitbart. Breitbart, just to give some context, he's born in 1893. We'll see that he dies as a very young man in 1925 in an accident, only age 32, during one of his performances. And it's a time of intense anti-Semitism. This is a picture in Germany, 1906. He grew up, he was born in Lodz, but he spent a number of years in Berlin. This is a classic picture of the kind of the Jewish male. What does it mean to Jewish man? So we'll see that Breitbart is a great bodybuilder. He's a great wrestler. He's a man considered the greatest, perhaps the strongest man to be alive. And yet he's operating in a context in which it was extremely common, an extremely common anti-Semitic trope, unfortunately, that Jewish men were enfeebled, were weak. Unfortunately, sometimes mocked as feminine, which was an insult both to Jews and to all women simultaneously. Neither of which, of course, were acceptable or mildly appropriate, and yet this is the context in which Breitbart is born, in literally smack in the middle of Poland. So we talked about these Eastern European yeshivos. He went to Cheder. He grew up in an observant home, and he very quickly grew up. There are There's not much known about the early years of Breitbart's life, but there are children's books that have been written. This is obviously not a historical account, but this is taken from a 2010 children's book that imagines or retells the legend. And this is a kind of retelling of this young man who's just 3 years old. And in this telling, and literally there are children's books about Zisha Breitbart. Who would have thought that a Polish Jew, right? This is giving, gives you a sense of the pride that the Jews of that time ultimately were to have, in someone who grew to, such fame. Who would have thought that a Polish Jew, son of a poor blacksmith, would become the strongest person in the world? When Zisha was 3 years old, he loved to watch his father work. He would pick up a 9-pound hammer, swing it round, and pound it on the anvil. He laughed when he heard the crashing noise it made. So this is like sort of some sort of admixture of sort of like there's a reversal of the story, the Midrashim about Avraham Avinu, who is also three, right? In some of the records of that classic Midrash, when he comes to recognize the Kadosh Baruch Hu, smashes the idols in Terach's idol shop. There's something of that, except here he's an extension of the Jewish community. He's not breaking away from the previous generations, but he's somehow an extension or building on them. And then again, instead of the younger Eloi, who knows Chas and Poskim at age three, hear the legends that were told. And there were legends we don't historically, again, this is about as reliable as any other story that might be told about a three-year-old who already knew Chas and Poskim. But as they say, they don't tell stories like that about me and you. And the same has been said and can be said for Zisha. By age four, there certainly were rumors that went around that he would work with his father in the iron shop. And he would, essentially, work with metals. And he was a full-fledged partner in his father and older brother's work in the blacksmith shop. We do know historically his father was a blacksmith, a poor blacksmith at that, and that Zisha helped out for many, many years, starting at age four. There's historical evidence to that effect. So here we have this young man who grows up known to the Jewish community as having achieved, at least later on known to the Jewish community as having achieved a certain level of superhuman strength. And at a certain point, he becomes recognized. His early years are mired in difficulty and obscurity. He's captured while serving during World War I. He struggles to make ends meet. But in 1919, he begins to basically put on little performances on the corners in Germany. By that time, he had gotten married. He would have one child. It's rumored, generally assumed, that he actually married the daughter of a rabbi. He was, unfortunately, was no longer observant, but as we'll see, he at the very least maintained a tremendous amount of Jewish pride. It's worth adding as well that, unfortunately, at that time in the shtetl, in that world, as it were, unfortunately, there were many who were carried away by the winds of that time. Socialism, communism, and as we'll see, Zionism in the case of Breitbart as well. Unfortunately, removed their kippahs, and it was a very, very difficult time religiously for the Jewish community of Eastern Europe. And he was certainly swept away by the winds of those times. But instead of rejecting his Judaism, as we'll see, he embraced it. But certainly by no means, unfortunately, was not Shomer Torah Mitzvos in any way beyond his the younger years of his childhood, which is unfortunate. But it also helps us historically to frame the reaction from the Jewish community, as we will see. 1919, he's performing on some street corner, I believe it's in Berlin, and someone who's involved in the famed Circus Busch, and this is known as the most prominent and famous of the circuses at that time. They had circuses performing all over Europe, and in the United States, they were involved in getting those started as well. This is, if you thought Big Apple was chashuv, Circus Busch perhaps even more chashuv, but really it was a dominant cultural icon, really, at that time. So much so that there were people like someone you might have heard of, Harry Houdini, who performed and was picked up. His act was picked up by Circus Busch, and there he is in one of his famous escape artist performances, speaking of performances, right? There's Houdini yet again, and you get a sense as to the kind of dramatic performances that were common and that were most esteemed by the circus and that had picked up on this completely unknown, poverty-ridden son of a blacksmith on the streets of Berlin performing just to make ends meet after having just been released from captivity from World War I. And at the beginning, Breitbart is just kind of a sideshow. He kind of is an opening act, and they put him physically in a separate building. He's kind of like off-Broadway, if you will. But very quickly, he's recognized not only for his physical prowess, but for his immense acting talents, and he begins to rise in fame. And all of a sudden, within just a few very short years, 1921, 1922, 1923, see him skyrocketing. So this is 100 years ago, essentially skyrocketing to fame across Eastern, Central, and Western Europe, places like Prague, places like Berlin, locations in Poland, and other major centers where the circus had their act and where they traveled through. And Breitbart began to develop these different personas, and he would adopt many different Gentile, essentially, kind of classic, prototypical, masculine, physical embodiments, essentially costumes that he would wear for his performances. This is one of the less sanua, but if you go online, you can find lots more. At the bottom of this picture, if you can see, it says Eisenkönig, which is, I believe, German for the Iron King, and he became to be known as the Jewish Hercules by his adoring Gentile audiences. He became known as the Azisha, or even Gershon Breitbart, as I said, by his Jewish audiences. The Yiddisha Shimshine is what he was called, the Samson the Great, the modern day Samson, who, by implication, if we take the model of Shimshon HaGibor, had somehow come to perhaps even save his people at a time of, again, intense rising anti-Semitism, and really, miracle of miracles, just absolutely remarkably, at a time when Jewish men were caricatured as being weaklings, as we saw, and really had become one of the most central kind of stereotypes that was bandied about Jews at that time, to the point that then, once the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, rose to power in 1933, they adopted many of these ideas and incorporated it into their literature and all sorts of ideas along those lines. But essentially, but it's very interesting that that nonetheless, precisely in that environment, Breitbart puts on these performances, and they are embraced by Jews and Gentiles alike at a time of fast rising anti-Semitism in Germany and Austria. Just to give you a sense, he wears a Magen David. He wears a Star of David to a number of his performances. It's like these boxers who wear their, you know, their, whatever, they're draped by the flag of their country, the United States, or what have you, right? So you can almost see, right? It's like the Jewish Rocky, right? He's coming out like no one would have expected. Of course, he's not like Rocky in the sense that he actually is physically built. He really is considered to be acknowledged to be the most powerful individual. So it's not that he's overcoming his actual brute strength, but he's almost considered to be a freak of nature by those who spend their entire lives thinking about Jewish men as being weaklings, and yet here he is, the strongest man in the world, is not only how he's branded, but ultimately how he comes to be seen. Really remarkable how this Jew walks in parading to with the Magen David in early 20th century Germany, not even so early anymore, post World War I, nonetheless rises to such acclaim. And he wears many interesting costumes, just to give you a sense of some of the others that he dons. So here's one. Here's another classic one. He is known based on his young upbringing. You see those almost Herculean Roman, the footwear that he would put on, and kind of the cape over here. But there he has metal straps. This comes from his upbringing as the child of a blacksmith. But it also has generally been understood that actually, strangely enough, again, it's uncomfortable almost to say, but it was generally considered to be by his Jewish audiences a kind of a play on tefillin. What he would do is actually get a sense of this. The closest picture I was able to find, he would take actually as part of his show, he would literally wrap metal around his arms as a feat of strength. And obviously, he's adopting from and adapting his young youthful experience as a Jew. Unfortunately, he's no longer wearing tefillin, but he's not putting on the tefillin to, God forbid, mock or to reject his upbringing. I think it's more just almost kind of he's taking his Jewish cultural roots and adapting them to this new sense of Jewish pride that he seeks to instill into his audiences and that he simply embodies. Again, in a highly untraditional way, but nonetheless, remarkably, literally, we have records of him impressing his show, his crowds, throngs of people who were cheering him on while he was pretending, as it were, to put on tefillin. Of course, some understood, but most in the audience would not have understood. But that was essentially what he was doing, except he was just bending a metal that was really impossible for anyone else to bend. And so he's undercutting many of these stereotypes about Jews and still drawing on his Jewish past in these kind of ambivalent and strange ways, getting up as a centurion, as a caped superhero, armor laden. He is surrounded by many. He had numerous bodyguards who, of course, making sure to take care of him, as well as highly adoring fans, while he walked around biting metal. And that was much of what he would do. He would bite through chains. He would bend rods into horseshoes. He pounded nails into boards with his fist. He drew chariots with his teeth and all sorts of other strongman, as you can see, pretty impressive feats. This is a classic one. And him just, you know, he's down there. It doesn't look totally comfortable, but nonetheless, it's somewhat impressive that as they pound down on him there, he's able to support all of these rocks. Here's another classic one of him again supporting. You see the legwear again. You see the costumes. And the costumes were really kind of his trademark. And it wasn't that he was just considered the strongest man in the world, and maybe he was, maybe he wasn't, but again, he had the branding and he had the talent to put on this show, to put on this performance that the throngs of people coming out at that time, and it was a time that was a difficult time, people were probably looking for a lot of distractions and a lot of entertainment, and so his legend grows through the early 1920s. He increasingly becomes the talk of every single town. They would have him traveling throughout various communities, wherever he would perform. One reporter noted that not only do gymnasium students and high school girls talk about him, right? So the everyone's talking about him, even first graders, right? This is not the Yidden, right? Even first graders know how strong Breitbart is. Literally a Jewish countercultural cultural icon. It's really went that way. There was one owner of a tavern who would complain, "My tables are studded with holes because my customers test their strength by hammering nails into them with their open hands. All Viennese women are in love with this new Samson. Racial hatred, pride, or prudishness, all of it is useless here." So really, there's just that sense that he just became the talk of the town and became a cultural dynamo, really an institution in his own right. He attracted enemies. He attracted one individual during his Breitbart's first month in Vienna. The obsession had shown no signs of waning, and the city was in a, quote, as one reporter put it at that time, mass hypnotic state. And there was an old rival of his and an entrepreneur by the name of Eric Jan Hanusen essentially said, I can match him. It's not a problem. He takes a 19-year-old girl. He says, I'm going to simply hypnotize her. And once I hypnotize her, she'll be able to do this. The same muscular impressive feats that Breitbart does, she'll do the same thing. It's not a problem. He puts on a show. And while he's up there, he there are these independent judges who make their way out, and they catch them in the middle of swapping out real iron for pseudo iron at the very last moment, and Husin is exposed as a con man, and Breitbart achieves even greater acclaim for all of his accomplishments. He then travels to New York, 1923, 1924. He tours the United States. This is a picture of him pulling wagons with his, obviously with his teeth. Again, the iron theme, and kind of more of a different uniform as he was being bandied about places like the Lower East Side of Manhattan. Jewish and non-Jewish crowds alike were, again, adoring. And he travels through places like Cleveland, St. Louis, and a number of other places in North America, among them as well, Cleveland and Toronto. And I'll explain to you why that's significant in just a moment. Just to give a little bit more, this is him dressed up like a blacksmith of his youth. So this is, again, another one of his costumes. Always the performer, right? Widely publicized, right? Talk of the town, as you can see here. And this is a picture of actually Yahunsen, the one who attempted to expose Breitbart, but instead was exposed himself, essentially being sued in court I believe in Vienna, but I'm not certain, back in roughly 1923. As Breitbart, oh, I just gave that one away. As Breitbart is traveling around, he goes to two cities in particular. One is Cleveland and the other is Toronto, which is especially interesting because there are two individuals whose names, again, you might have heard of, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, who were the ones who conceived of the Superman / Clark Kent persona. And there have been many, many theories over the course of the years as Clark Kent / Superman as sort of this immigrant Jewish persona who was this mild manner person who would work extremely hard and on the surface was sort of not physically powerful, physically confident in any way. And yet beneath the surface, just beneath the facade, in fact, was indeed from another planet, wasn't even human, was superhuman, and the whole famed legend that grew out of Superman. And while we don't have any record of them mentioning Breitbart's influence, there have been at least serious historians who have suggested that it's hard to imagine that this was not at least part of what might have impacted on their decision to develop this personality. Note that Breitbart was actually very often wore a cape at his performances. He was advertised as, quote, capable of stopping speeding locomotives, which might sound familiar again for all the Superman fans out there. I think there's even a new one that's apparently it's just starting right now, like maybe even today or yesterday. I don't know. Maybe someone else can fill me in afterward. But I think there's like a new, yet another Lois and Clark spinoff. The 100 years later, the legend remains alive. Is it possible that Breitbart became the inspiration? And what does that say? This kind of mixed persona that perhaps he came to embody, which we'll come back to in just a few minutes' time. Whether or not he was the inspiration for Superman, certainly that's how he was seen. And it was suggested, again, there you have Breitbart and that famed image that we used on the cover, Where Do You Come From, Superman. One author suggesting this identity, that perhaps he was modeled after Breitbart. Others saying, no, Superman is not Jewish, right? Even children's book debating this important historical question. But Breitbart, either way, goes on to not just become a famous performer, but he's also a talented and sophisticated businessman. He has a lot of business acumen. He starts to publish books. He writes his autobiography, which is probably ghost-written, but nonetheless, he knows how to get the word out there. Like someone who has a real sensibility about promotion. He features as the major personality in a film at that time, 1923, Der Eisenkönig, The Iron King, starring Sigmund Breitbart. You can still watch it in case you need a good Purim. I don't know if it's good. I haven't seen it. It's Austrian. I don't even know if there are English subtitles. So I can't promise that this is going to be entertaining for Purim or even interesting in the least bit. I haven't quite seen it yet. But if anyone knows Austrian or is interested in learning, it might be a good place to start. But you can still find Breitbart on Amazon Prime Video, Ad Hayom Hazeh. That's pretty remarkable. He goes on to build a muscle builder apparatus. He has a whole mail in order system going on. He puts out booklets about his training methods, how to become so powerful, how to be healthy. He's got his whole Breitbart diet regimen, the whole nine yards, sort of anticipating many of the multidimensionality of the modern day strong man, but kind of well-rounded athlete in that way, who ate healthily, who was physically strong in all of those dimensions. Tragically, in 1925, Breitbart has returned and resumed his European tours. He's in, I believe he's in Berlin at the time, and ironically, with all of his feats of impressive physicality, he ended up tragically mortally wounding himself while performing simply by driving an iron stake through a piece of wood, which for him was relatively tame. He accidentally scrapes it against his leg. He suffers an injury. There are no antibiotics at that time. The infection becomes worse, and within a matter of just a number of weeks, unfortunately, tragedy has struck, and Breitbart, with all of his adoring fans, has died. This is a contemporary retelling of the story. On the right, you see, again, him in costume and a reenactment of the tragic accident. On the end, it's the last minuten von Zisha Breitbart, right? The last minutes of Zisha Breitbart in 1925. I won't claim to have particularly good Yiddish, but even I was able to manage to make that out with his, again, his royal image kind of being there, and that perhaps is his loving wife at that time. This is an original picture from his funeral. Again, throngs of many, many people, all sorts of different walks of life. Despite his lack of observance, he certainly is buried, as you can see immediately, in a Jewish cemetery in Berlin. And we actually have his, I wouldn't say that people daven at his kever, but I would say that there are, it's not a coincidence that at the very least, there are legends or rumors about people having been encouraged to, if not daven, then at least to visit. Again, it's like almost like he's a Rebbe, but of a different sort. The press at that time widely publicizes the passing of Breitbart. There's an outcry. GTA was around and remains around. Zisha Breitbart dies from blood poisoning. The New York Times reports about it as well, at least so I saw, having yet been able to dig out the original archives. So we're still working on that. But certainly in many, many newspapers at that time, and in Berlin, Warsaw, and Vienna, all the different places where he had performed, there's a sense of a tremendous tragedy and reporting of his death. An Hayom Hazeh, very recently, in 2001, for example, there was a movie, Invincible, which was based on the life of Breitbart, although it places him in Nazi Germany, which is, of course, not historical. He died in 1925, but still they were making movies about his legend in 2001. And as I mentioned, as late as 2010, the Kar Ben series, I think this is from PJ Library, published a book. It's a fascinating book. You can even get it online. I bought it for like $6.99, and then I very quickly learned that it's not exactly historical, but it's certainly very telling, as we'll see, in terms of the legend of Breitbart, but I wouldn't rely on it for historical purposes. Immediately says that he was born in 1883, which actually many have said, but in fact, as we saw earlier, it says on his kever 1893, but I'm not here to pick historical fights about children's books, I'm here just to point out that in 2010, someone thought to write a book about Zisha the Strongman, obviously at least to some degree, even after so much of the history and that community was completely wiped out over the course of the Shoah. Nonetheless, and perhaps precisely because of the tragedies that we suffered, during that era, Zisha, Superman, etc., is continues to be larger than life, and his continues to be sort of an image, almost a fantasy of the Jewish individual being able to fight back and to defend himself. Now, what's fascinating is a number of things. At first glance, Breitbart is somewhat anomalous, of course, as this Jewish strongman, not exactly what we might have expected. Certainly, if you walk around, if you look at Purim costumes, I'm not sure that boxers or martial artists or what have you is necessarily the most common costume that our children or community members, at least around my parts, my narrow circles where I travel, tend to be contemporarily the norm. But nonetheless, he's adored both by Gentiles who speak about him in Austrian, in addition to German, all sorts of languages. And again, of course, by Jews, Gershon, Breitbart. This is announcing a planned program or event. Yiddishen Gibor in the bottom right. Right, he's called Shimshon HaGibor. If you see in the smaller text more about Breitbart, again, he's claimed to be an authentic Jew by the Jewish community in Europe at that time. And what's remarkable is that alongside his public persona and the fact that he was incredibly physically powerful, he was nonetheless able to, again, buck these anti-Semitic trends and to be massively popular, perhaps the only living Jew at that time to in Eastern Europe to be as popular as he was, equally among Jews and Gentiles alike. That's actually a stunning kind of historical achievement at that time. But he was even more than that. And this is where it really becomes interesting. He wasn't just the most powerful Jew in the world. He wasn't just a proud Zionist Jew, but he was even more well-rounded than that. He was certainly a passionate Zionist. He had a personal relationship with Jabotinsky. That's a picture of the famed revisionist Zionist. They knew each other well. They planned, almost plotted together, it seems. They spoke on a number of occasions and had a close relationship. Breitbart felt that a return to Israel through strength was necessary for the Jews to combat anti-Semitism at that time. And he had a very close relationship with Jabotinsky, and Jabotinsky wasn't quite as athletic as the public, the pure intellectual in terms of his part. But Breitbart, whether it's factual or not, we don't know, but legend had it that he actually desired to make Aliyah and to be the general of an Israeli army, or what would become the army of the nascent state of Israel. Which, again, we don't know if that quite is historically true, but it fits very nicely with everything that we do know. And remember, he wasn't just physically strong, but he had fought in World War I. And even if it's not true, again, it says something quite authentic about his historical personality. And again, even in his public presentations, he had him, as we said, Magen David. I don't have a picture of him with the flag, but there is a very famous picture of him acting. He's now as a blacksmith. He's dressed. So he's going back to his youth. He takes it. I don't know if that's a Jewish symbol necessarily, that he's got it. He's got the iron in there, although he had the tefillin earlier, but certainly the Magen David was something he did not hide from. But again, he held out with tremendous pride. In fact, there was one performance of his in Krakow where they refused to let him sing the song or to play. He's running out, it's like he's a boxer or something like that. He's running out, to his ring, as it were, for his performance, and he would always enter to music. And in some of these years, many of these performances, he would march out to Hatikva, which had already been composed at that time. And there was one particular location that had hosted him, that invited him in Krakow. And when he performed, they refused to play Hatikva. And he said, I'm never coming back to play for you. So again, he certainly has this tremendous sense of Jewish pride that goes along with muscularity. And again, the fact that he was able to represent the Jewish community, putting on these performances, even as he's so proudly Jewish and so openly Jewish, and yet adored by literally millions and millions of people, an international following, performing all over the world, really a globetrotter, truly is perhaps the exception that on one level that proves the rule, but still nonetheless, was really a remarkable accomplishment. But then there's even more. You could just look at the children's book, but what's interesting is that in these pages taken from that 2010 book, we see again something not necessarily historical, but something that captures something certainly about the way that Breitbart was remembered in his death and long afterward. For example, in addition to or alongside his strength, Zisha was also gentle. So says the Barken book from 2010. He loves small animals. He would hold tiny mice in his hands. He loved to feed nuts to the squirrels. This Jewish strongman is simultaneously, he's soft, he's gentle, he loves animals. He wouldn't hurt a fly, as others put it. He also liked listening to music. He learned to play the cello. By the way, historically, the former about animals was reported during his life. The latter about the music lessons, I'm not sure that's historically accurate. But nonetheless, again, it's kind of part of this legend that developed alongside these public displays of brute strength and immense muscularity. At the same time, before he was famous, to earn money for his music lessons, he used his strength to carry and haul things for others. So here we have a later presentation of Zisha using his strength so that he could do something much more tender and gentle. And there are many, many stories about his kindness, not just his softness and his cultured side, but simply him as a Baal Chesed. There was one, there's a series of testimonials with his, I think it's his great nephew who is interviewed, and there are additional historical accounts about this. He once met a representative of the community that was in the middle of a famine, that was poverty stricken, and he basically donated enough food for the community for an entire week. It was an entire city. It was a massive amount of money, although we don't know exactly how much it was, but it was very substantial. He gave tzedakah to many as well. Again, in the children's book, he would visit, right? People would ask him, he'd say, I train hard. What's your secret? He replied, I train hard, eat good foods, and I pray to God. Again, did he daven on a regular basis? I suspect not, unfortunately. But again, he was claimed by the Jewish community not only much later on, more recently, but during his lifetime and immediately after his passing as well. He travels to America. He would take time to visit his fellow Jews, play cello for children at local hospitals. His heart was as great as his strength. Again, is this historically accurate? I'm not sure, but certainly this captures much of the spirit with which Breitbart was held. And again, this fits very nicely with what we know about kind of the duality of a Superman persona who kind of has both of these dimensions, right? He's got the kind of the icy stare looking at the bad guy and ready to kill him, of course, though, for a noble purpose, and yet kind of that kind of stereotypical, you'll forgive me, Jewish kind of, right? He's hidden behind the glasses and all of that. The mild-mannered reporter, and again, I don't mean to say that in terms of stereotype, but that's kind of how it was, that's how Clark Kent was seen by many. And again, the connection to Breitbart might be far from coincidental and says a lot about the possibility for having actually more than one kind of persona and kind of the multiple dimensions of who Breitbart really was. There are many others, for lack of time, I can read this inside, but a review of that movie, which came out later, said that the lead actor who played the role of Breitbart, this is that one that was set in Nazi Germany, that he plays this naive, strongman tortured by visions of a horrible future event, but his physicality, warmth, and childlike kindness and is actually reminiscent of Andre the Giant, right? So that'll give you a sense, like this gentle giant. That's really, he's this nice guy. He's right. He's caring. He's soft, and so on and so forth. To the point that actually, when he was touring the United States, there was a prominent newspaper in California that declared that strongest living man, quote, does dishes for wife, makes clothes for the baby. He was out with the chains and the irons, putting on these Roman centurion Herculean kinds of performances. But at home, he was changing diapers and he was taking care of everything together with his wife, partnering on that. In this article from something from the Californian, from his time in the United States. So this really speaks volumes about that. Now, a seafarer might not necessarily be what you would have expected to see next. And yet, this is one of the classic Sfarim that was written by the Radziner Rebbe. The Radziner Rebbe was renowned as sort of Chanuch Leiner was renowned as a leading Hasidic Rebbe in the late 19th, early 20th century, and many Hasidic followers. He believed that he had discovered the secret of the Tchiles and the identity of the Chilazon. He was the first in modern times to attempt the reinstitution of the Tchiles. And you might say, Ma inyan Breitbart, itzel the Radziner. The answer is, well, the Radziner's Hasidim were big fans also, and they used to go out to the shows, and the Radziner, of course, was not so comfortable with this, all of this. And so Breitbart's representatives get in touch with the Rebbe, and they make a deal, and the Rebbe invites Breitbart to actually come out and to put on a show for him, believe it or not, and to speak with him and to get to know him. Because the Rebbe wanted to know, am I Hasidim seeing something that's totally treif and what's pshat? And maybe he overplayed the Jewish elements of his presentation. It's hard to know. It's lost to history. We do not have a recording, tragically, of that historic meeting or any record of that historic meeting beyond the fact that it did take place. But we do know that there are real historical sources that he donated 30 pounds of flour to the Radziner Rebbe so that his Hasidim could use them to bake matzos for Pesach. So again, it's fascinating, right? Somehow these different pieces live together. And it's not just that he respected, rabbis. He was a real intellectual also. He had many, many books in his personal library. I don't mean to say he learned on a regular basis or that he completed Daf Yomi and was at the Siyum HaShas before there was a Siyum HaShas or anything like that, but he was an intellectual. He respected Yiddish intellectuals. He respected Rabbanim as well, not only for their scholarship, but for their leadership as well. And there were numerous relationships that he maintained. And what's fascinating is that there are numerous later Musar Svarim who actually quote Breitbart. This is pretty remarkable. If you take a look at this particular Makor. This is from the Sichos Musar of Rav Yeruchom Lubavitch, and he actually quotes Breitbart. He writes, "Kishchala Hagibor Hayadua Breitbart." V'cholash kol kach, when he became sick and he became so weakened, ad shelo hayachol lahachzik et biyado, he could no longer hold a pen with his hand. There was a sofer, there was a scribe who said, Osan yadayin shishibru motos barzel. How could it be, right? Ichnaflu giborim as well, right? The fall of this giant, right? How could it be that someone whose hands tore apart or were able to bend iron rods, right? Yiradu ma'at, right? May eight katan v'kal, that they should shiver while they even attempt to hold this little pen. And he says, it goes on to the Musarvort, is he goes on to say that no, the answer is that we take for granted holding a pen. And we only think that Breitbart's, that his strength, that was Minas Shemayim. But the truth is that Breitbart teaches us something about all of us, all of our strength, no matter how strong we are or are not physically, every aspect or every dimension of any degree of strength that we have have even what it takes to hold a pen. It's all min hashamayim. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu is teaching us through the during the illness of Breitbart that it all comes min hashamayim, that it all comes on HaKadosh Baruch Hu, whether you're bending iron or holding a pen in your hands, everything. Again, the fact that Breitbart is held up as someone from whom we can learn Moser lessons is nothing short of stunning, right, certainly outstrips what many would have done. Many who would not have quoted, the Rav Kooks of the world, or even more recently the Rav Soloveitchiks of the world, at the time when his reputation was hotly disputed in the Olam HaYeshivos. At the same time, Breitbart somehow was okay to quote. And then I found some fascinating stories, and I'm happy to send this to anyone, from a sefer, the Darchei Musar, about talks in Lita, at the bottom right, that was the Yehudi Gibor b'shem Zisha Breitbart, who would come and he would put on in Lahad Yershim Yisrael bin Agoyim. He would come, he was a Kiddush Hashem, right? Basically taking the name of the Bnei Yisrael, at least, if not Hashem, and spreading it positively throughout the nations. Someone asked him, what was the secret to your strength? And he says he never gave up no matter what. He just believed in his abilities in all circumstances. And they even talk about this elderly Yid who was sitting in the back of a Pirkei Avos shir, heard the name of Breitbart mentioned, started chuckling. The Rav who was giving the Pirkei Avos shir says, what's pshat? Like, you never laughed during my shiur, and all of a sudden you're chuckling. So he's an old friend of mine. Me and Breitbart, hayinu yididim tovim, middle of the left column, we were good buddies. And he says that so they said, is it really true that he stopped a train with his bare hands? So he says, "Any yodea machin zanachan." I don't know if that's true. Aval alaylo misaprim keilu siporim. Right? They don't tell stories like that about me and you. Again, it's almost like he is he's a gadol. And the question is really, what are we to make of all of this? How can the same person be so many things at the same time? This public persona of this Gibor who inspires loyalty among Jews and Gentiles alike. At the same time, he is an intellectual. At the same time, he's this soft, sweet, caring individual who's known, and by the way, I didn't mention earlier, but he's eulogized literally for his Edelkeit. That word was used on numerous occasions, including by the rabbi then of the community of the city of Berlin at that time, 1925. A Rabbi Monk, not the same Rabbi Monk from France who wrote on the Siddur, but talked about his Edelkeit. He was again an intellectual. He had relationships with and was immensely respected by Rabbanim as a young man who had thrown off the old Torah u'mitzvos and took metal and wrapped it around his arm like it was a pair of tefillin to show off his strength. How could all of this be? How could he somehow overcome the kind of stereotypes about what it meant to be a Jewish man at that time and to gain the adoration of so many of the anti-Semites at that time, and simultaneously to be respected and appreciated in his own way by Rabbanim, by community members, etc. And more than that, who was the real Breitbart? How do we reconcile the various parts of his personality, the public performance, the non-performance? And by the way, I didn't mention that when he was younger, he got into all sorts of fights. He was kicked out of many yeshivos, kind of familiar story. But that was him, and that's how he ended up, serving in World War I. So it wasn't like he just was like this this gentleman his whole life. He certainly had his moments as a young, somewhat violent young man as well. And I think the pshat is that is really twofold in the legacy of Breitbart, and I think it gives us a profound psychological insight, which is, I think, quite relevant ultimately, perhaps unexpectedly, to the performances of Purim as well. First, we ask the question, who was the real Breitbart? Will the real one really stand up? And it's almost like asking, right, will the real Superman stand up? Will the real person who's wearing a mask on Purim, or will the real person who's playing the Rosh Hashiva, who's chosen to play the role of the Rosh Hashiva, and is known as both the Gaon in the Yeshiva, but also the funny man in the Yeshiva, and I know I'm thinking of specific individuals have been asked to play the role of various YU Rosh Yeshiva, and kind of known as like a great Talmidim and simultaneously just hysterically funny. It kind of all came out on Purim. On one level, it's a release. On one level, what we said earlier, I think, is true, that there's a way in which the strictures of the yeshiva environment, of the Eastern European environment, at that time, really of everyday life, for just living everyday life, can be exhausting, can be taxing, it can be anxiety-provoking, and we all need that release from time to time. Purim comes at the end of the winter, at the end of a long Zman Yeshiva for a Ben Yeshiva, and so on and so forth. There's certainly that dimension as well. But I think that there's something more and deeper that's going on, because I think the truth is that, yes, Breitbart is putting on a show, and yes, the guy wants to earn a buck, but he also really is a strong man, and clearly this is something that there's a lot of testimony that he enjoyed. But did this contradict the fact that he was a proud Jew? Does this contradict the fact that he was as gentle as they come? That he represented kind of all these different dimensions of what it meant to be Jewish and to be masculine at the same time? I think there's no contradiction. And I think because all of these were true, and precisely because it was perceived as a performance, or could be perceived as a performance, I think that's why he was accepted successfully by Jews and Gentiles alike, because they were each attracted to different pieces of his personality. Gentiles could kind of write him off as this Jewish freakish athlete. It was, again, the exception who proved the rule. He could be seen as someone who was really not a threat, because ultimately he was kind of this non-threatening Jew. They didn't know the whole part about him perhaps wanting to be a general. They didn't know the whole Zionism part. They, in terms of the army piece of it, they just knew that he was a proud Jew. That's fine, so long as you keep it on the stage, we can kind of make this an object of our entertainment, but imagine to ourselves that he's not actually a threat in real life, even as I think that was one essential part of his personality. At the same time, the other side of him as well, right? The Jews at that time were able to say, of course he's a strong man, but he has Edelkeit. Simultaneously is a Zionist. Depending on who you are, you could attach yourselves to so many different aspects of his personality, all of which were fully authentic. He had immense kavod for Rabbanim. He was not personally frum, but he grew up understanding and having reverence for that kind of community, to the point that it was quoted by later Musar masters. Right? All of these could be were authentic parts of his personality that kind of were all there. And just like Lehavdil Elef Alfei Avdalos, there were so many Gedolei Hador who were so complex that different Talmidim would take on different parts of their personality. Lehavdil, that was true of Breitbart as well. And I think that was what allowed his multidimensionality, allowed different people to read him in different ways, to take different parts of his persona. And of course, the Jews were certainly proud to allow for someone that would allow them to live out their fantasies at a time of increasing anti-Semitism. No question about that as well. Again, much the same as kind of the dream of the Superman who would come to save the Jews from the anti-Semites, much like the legend of the Golem. And so on and so forth. And I think it's fascinating, and I'm not going to go into it now, but there's a scholar named Victor Turner who develops this about public personas and carnivals and kind of masquerading and all of this. But I think that, he does make the point in the middle that public liminality, this notion of kind of like occupying this middle space, which is neither here nor there, these performances can never be tranquilly regarded as a safety valve, mere catharsis, letting off steam, right? And rather, really, it is kind of an essential way of putting new ideas forward, but I would suggest for our purposes, a reflection of one of the many aspects of our identity. Certainly nowadays, we don't typically have this. This is not a regular part of our Purim celebration. But I think it's really interesting to think about at this time. And I would just close on a somewhat more serious note, which is as follows. I think Breitbart is a fascinating case in point because his mix of masculinity, how he both confirmed and shattered cultural assumptions about what it meant to be a Jew, and how he was able to do that precisely because he was able to bring together this multidimensionality, I think is actually quite profound into the symbolism of kind of the performances that Purim represents. I think it's true that getting dressed up on Purim is kind of a safety valve. It's a healthy way of maintaining the typical structures of society because we kind of get let off our steam and kind of, you know, mock or make fun or put on a show or what have you. But I think the same thing at the same time, it's also true that it is healthy and it's part of our personalities for many of us to need a release from time to time and to explore and to discover different parts of who we are in a much more serious way. I think this past year, unfortunately, because of the tremendous tragedies that we've suffered and because of the very strange and difficult circumstances 1 year in on the Jewish calendar, in the shadow of the pandemic, as we think about it, we've been forced, coerced under terrible circumstances to sometimes, for better or for worse, to find new parts of our personality that are authentic, but perhaps had been hidden there. And it's my bracha that first and foremost that we merit very soon to return to the full joy of Purim, where we can fully put on these different personalities, put on the shtick, put on the shvils as full performances of a kind of representing our full complexity and who we truly are in a full way. But more than that, that Purim be an opportunity, Mirtza Hashem, for us to perhaps discover aspects of our connection, if not as our status as bodybuilders in one case, but certainly aspects of our personality, of our connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, of our chesed, of our esteem for Talmidei Chachamim, or what have you, whatever it might be, that perhaps were otherwise obscured. So Breitbart might not have been the most obvious candidate for figuring out the notion of costume, but actually it turns out that someone who is always putting on a performance and always in costume has a profound amount to teach us about what that represents and what that means to us. And with that, I wish everyone a Freilichen and happy Purim to all. And I wish everyone a good evening. And I'm happy to stay on with anyone who has any questions and wish everyone a great evening. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Sinensky. This is Emily Passau.
Hi, Emily.
Good to see you again.
Okay, pleasure.
How did you discover this
character? That is a fine question. So a little bit of my PhD studies that I'm happy to fill you in on. About how essentially men have been kind of the notion of masculinity, how men have been idealized and portrayed throughout history and within halachic sources, within Jewish sources, in the Gemara, etc. There's just some fascinating things. So what is the ideal man? And Breitbart is really a fascinating example and case study in terms of that. If it weren't the Purim Shir, we just kind of go and drill in into that. But he's just a fascinating kind of personality where he, on the one hand, breaks away from this stereotype and he's able to carry all these people away, but he's sort of only able to do that by simultaneously carrying what it means to be kind of your stereotypical Jewish man. He has the Eidel Kites, right? And he has the rabbinic credentials and he has this appreciation and this kind of, you know, Zionists. Most Zionists were considered to be, you know, right? They were Apikorsim and all of that. V'nafochu, like he's celebrated even by Rabbanim as someone who's like, ah, like for him it was okay. If you were from anywhere Zionist, it was very problematic. But if you're Breitbart, right? Like, you know, actually, like it's a Kiddush Hashem. It's really quite fascinating. That's how I came to this. But I think it's a fascinating case study in terms of kind of what are the limits and what are the opportunities of what it means to grow up as a man in a Jewish community and Jewish environment.
Thank you.
Sure, of course. Anyone else? Feel free. Is anyone chatting or just saying thank you all? Okay. He was the Jewish Shimshon, as if the original was not. That's a good he'ara from Chaim earlier on. I think that that's right. Like, in other words, Shimshon is itself, like, has a checkered past and is certainly not exactly your traditional model of, even of a shofet, right? And there's no question that his, not his Jewishness biologically, but his certainly his, right, the way he carries himself is a fascinating example. There's a lot of literature also about Shimshon and how he fits and doesn't fit. Chaim, you're talking, but I think you're muting. Muted. That's exactly, what?
In the least yeshivish
sefer, Ishkal Ayasher Ben Avyasa. And that's why it was okay to be Shimshon, because, like, you know, if that's the situation, you know? And by the way, the Shimshon Agibor was, I think, I didn't mention this, but I think Shimshon is also a reference, an allusion to the fact that he would destroy our enemies also, right? In other words, I think that's also pshat in Shimshon. Like, he's the Gibor, right? Wink, wink, he really, right? He's the Zionist going to help us to defeat our enemies. We're not going to say it, but that's really, that's what he means to us as well. I think there's that too. Anyone else? Okay. Tov. Freilich and Purim to all. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye.
Hola.